When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And each one of us had a 6 foot model with fishnet nylon, fishnet stuck with a big busk, whiskers, and a tiger's tail. Oh, and we sat up on the back seat of the car with a driver, each of us, with our arm around this model, and took off towards Manhattan with a motorcycle escort, you know, wailing sirens. It was hilarious.
Hello and welcome to episode 63 of Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate classic rock podcast that proudly claims that my music is better than yours. I'm Paul Stevenson, thanks as always for hitting play. Now, my guest on this week's show is another Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, one of the early inductees, having been inducted the same year as Elton John, Sir Rod Stewart, Bob Marley, John Lennon and the Grateful Dead. What a class that was. Now, he was part of the British Invasion with his band, being the second group from the UK to have a number one hit after the Beatles. They had 10 other singles in the UK and US top 20, so by no means a one-hit wonder. Now, Bruce Springsteen has publicly declared this band as his favourite British group of the 60s, and their best-known song is a classic rock anthem that regularly features on the best songs of all time lists conducted by various media outlets. I am, of course, talking about The Animals, and my guest today is founding member John Steele. Now, I've been working closely with Tenacity PR, who have helped to organise the Great British Rhythm and Blues Festival, Rock, Roots and Folk. It's taking place this August, the bank holiday weekend, Friday 26th to Sunday 28th, and it's got a fantastic lineup of R&B blues folk acts. Now, there's a few people I've interviewed on the show in the past, including 10 Years After drummer Rick Lee. His band is going to be there. Rick Lee, of course, as part of 10 Years After, played Woodstock, legendary. Now, I recently interviewed Ray Laidlaw as well, the Lindisfarne drummer from the Glory Days. The current Lindisfarne lineup will also be there, along with AOR favourites FM. You've got Atomic Rooster with Pete French involved, who's part of Cactus as well. You've got Dr. Feelgood, Gina Washington, and a host of other great acts as well, including John Steele's The Animals and Friends. Now, for more details, check out colnbluslineup.com or just Google Great British Rhythm and Blues Festival. You'll see all the information on there. But for this interview with John, then, as you'd expect, we're going to go through all of the big stuff for The Animals and the mega hit House of the Rising Sun, but also about the incredible reception they received in America, influencing Bob Dylan, a crazy party with Herman's Hermits while on tour in the US, and a bust up with Nina Simone. Yes, it's all to be heard in this interview. So please enjoy this chat with John Steele from the legendary British group The Animals. Well, it's an absolute pleasure to chat with you, John. Now, the Great British Rhythm and Blues Festival is taking place in Lancashire in August this year. Now, you're going to be part of a fantastic lineup. It's some fantastic names there. Are you looking forward to it?
Oh, yeah. I've played it a few times in the past when our agent, Peter Bond, organised the festival in past years, and then it's been like everything else. It's past 2 years and nothing's been happening. But it's good this year that it's back again, you know, because it's always a good gig.
Absolutely. Looking forward to that. And everyone can get their tickets now to see that. And they can also get their tickets to see you on tour. It's the farewell tour. It's been billed. You've done a few dates already, including one that's up my neck of the woods. I live in the Highlands of Scotland and you played up here near Elgin not too long ago. So
oh, yeah.
You've got some gigs lined up for the rest of the year across the UK. You're going out to Europe as well. Yeah. I mean, you're 81 now, John. I mean, do you still enjoy being out in front of the crowds as much as you always did?
I do. I love it. Yeah. Yeah, it's great fun. I don't know what else I would do.
And what sort of reaction do you get from the fans? And what kind of audience do you get nowadays?
It's mixed, really. Generally speaking, before the pandemic, we could always depend on the venue. You know, if it's theatres, we'd get a lot of, you know, older folks, but also a good sprinkling of young people. You know, if we're playing like blues clubs and festivals and things like that, it's a much younger audience. But we seem to have this broad appeal to pretty much any generation, you know, because people who are far too young to, you know, remember the songs on first time round, but they know all the words, you know, they pick up on the songs because they're such strong songs that we recorded back then that they've really stood up all these years and they still stand up now, you know.
Absolutely, and the band's name, and as you said, the songs themselves definitely do stand the test of time, and that shows with the amount of countries that you're going to go to across Europe as well.
Yeah, yeah, and Australia this year, later this year, bit of sunshine in November.
Can't blame you for that at all. Yeah. Now, let's go back to Through the Mists of Time then. I mean, you met Eric Burdon when you guys were young. Were you 15?
Yeah, 15.
There were twists and turns, there were lineup changes, there was different names, there was different members, all that sort of stuff, styles of music, and then The Animals were born. The first single you released, Baby Let Me Take You Home, landed around the top 20 in the UK, which is a fantastic achievement. But let's be honest, the song that came after it kind of changed everything for not just you guys, but for music as well, didn't it? I mean, we are obviously talking about House of the Rising Sun here.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a huge life-changing thing. That, I mean, the first single got us on radio play and a little bit of TV, and it sort of we arrived in a way. But House of the Rising Sun just took off and became number one in a short time, and then number one in the States, which was massive for us. You know, from being a sort of five-piece Geordie working-class lads. Suddenly flying off to America, it was like a dream, because, you know, everything that influenced us back in those days when we were kids, teenagers, seemed to come from it across the Atlantic, the blues, jazz, rock and roll, books, movies, whatever. So, and, you know, you couldn't just fly off the way you do nowadays to go and have a holiday in Florida. It was like just a rich man's top, you know, it was like another planet, in fact. So to be able to sort of arrive in New York with a number one in the charts. It was fantastic.
It's phenomenal indeed. Now, the song itself, like I said, it broke molds, didn't it? Because at that time, you're looking at 3 minutes maximum, weren't you, to get any sort of play on the radio. But this was 4.5 minutes, and it was the first folk rock song sort of thing to get to number one as well. You guys really did push the boundaries.
It did, yeah. I mean, I'm not sure how conscious of it we were at the time. I mean, when we recorded it, that was the first thing that the guy on the desk, the engineer, said, "You'll never get that played on the BBC because it's 4 minutes, 35 seconds or whatever." You know, like you said, two and a half, 3 minutes was the maximum for a single in those days. And that was the historic thing going back to 78 Revolution, 78 RPM records, where that was all you could get on the record, you know. So that broke that mold. As you say, first crossover folk rock thing. It also influenced Bob Dylan, changed his direction. Yes. Because we met him in New York a little later, and he'd just been in a studio recording his first electric folk rock stuff, because he was purely acoustic before that, you know. And he said he'd been driving his car and listening to the radio, and he heard our version of House of the Rising Sun, and he had a light bulb moment and thought, that's the way to go. We had a good night out with him as well, pub crawl around Greenwich Village.
I bet you did. Tell us about that meeting. I was going to bring that up a bit later, but let's talk about that now, because you guys were obviously big fans of Bob, and I think you kind of orchestrated a meeting while you're in New York to go and meet him. And the recording that you're talking about, I mean, it wasn't just any recording, it was a huge song of his as well, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, and we were big fans of Dylan from the start, from the first album. In fact, that was an influence on the first single we did, which was Baby Let Me Take You Home. Mm-hmm. Mickey Most, the producer, presented us with this record and said, "I think this will be a hit. And we thought it was a little bit middle of the road, you know, a bit poppy for us. Mm-hmm. But then we realized it was almost identical to a song in Bob Dylan's first album, which is Baby Let Me kind of Carry You Down or something like that. Very, very much the same. We thought, well, if it's good enough for Bob Dylan, it'll do for us, you know. That's why we went with that song. And then, of course, the second song, House of the Rising Sun, we just nicked that from the same album, you know. This is his acoustic version. We just loved the song, so we just kind of kicked it around until we came up with an arrangement that kind of fitted our style, you know.
Phenomenal. And you talk about fitting your style, because the arrangement that you did come up with, the feel, the tempo, the Eric's vocals on it, everything combined to make magic. Now, can you remember the roots of choosing that song and deciding to go down that path? Can you remember how the recording sessions went and the arranging and everything went for that song?
Yeah, we rehearsed it in the Club of Go-Go in Newcastle first of all. And funnily enough, although Alan gets the credit for the arrangement, he, Alan Price, the keyboard player, we had a little bit of a ruck about it because Hilton Valentine had come up with this arpeggio introduction, you know, and Alan got very huffy about that. He thought it should have been a sort of strummed acoustic thing, the same as the Dylan thing. He went off in a bit of a huff, and when he came back, we'd already finished, sorting our parts out. And then he more or less just came back in over his hoof and played that amazing solo, you know. And that was the arrangement.
Wow, that's incredible. I mean, Hilton's incredible intro is one of the most iconic things in music. And to think that if Alan would have had his way, that we would never have got
that's
that.
That's right, yeah. When we did record it, it was mainly Jazz's encouragement. But we were on the first Chuck Berry tour, the first time Chuck Berry came to the UK. Okay. And we got booked to support.
Yeah.
Among other bands, you know. And Chaz said, you know, everybody's going to be playing rock and roll. Chuck Berry, Carl Perkins, King's Ice Taylor and the Dominoes, the Nashville Teens, blah, blah. They were all on the tour. And he said, this song is a complete contrast. We should make a feature of it, you know. He must have had his business head even then, back, you know, before he became a manager and producer. So, and that's what we did, and that's what we got. This amazing reaction. You could feel it. So right in the middle of the tour, we got Mickey Most to fix a session in London, in this, where we did the first single, just a little basic underground studio. No tricks, no, it was just a mono, you know, what do you call it, a single track thing. Yeah. We went in there and in between Liverpool and Southampton in the middle of the night and set up, got some balance, played it through. And once, when we just played it through the one time, and Miggy said, come in and listen to this, you know, and we trooped into the control room, and that's when he said, I think we've got to hit single here, you know.
Phenomenal.
That's when the engineer said, it's too long. Yeah, but it was all done in one take.
Wow. I love hearing stuff like that. It's phenomenal.
I mean, show you something. You something. This, I was digging out some references for something else. I wrote there's a copy of a letter I wrote to my girlfriend at the time.
Oh, wow.
And it was written a couple of days after recording. And I said, I told you about Ready, Steady, Go. It's something like Ray Charles talking about you. This was going to be the sort of thing we did for Ready, Steady, Go. And the other side is Rising Sun. It's going to be a double A side, both sides. A sides. The Rising Sun sounds great. We did it in one take. That was written 2 days after the recording.
Wow. That's phenomenal. It's phenomenal you've still got that copy.
You kept all the letters. We got married after that, you know.
Incredible stuff. Now, in terms of being here in the UK, I mean, your music at the time, it was different. It had a darker edge to it, didn't it? So your audience over here were mostly guys, weren't it? Mostly fellas. But as you said, you went over to America. It was completely different for you.
Yeah.
It was a different audience altogether.
Teeny boppers. That's what they called them then. Yeah, exactly right. I mean, everywhere we played in Europe up until then, was generally we were a guys band, you know. And then, as I say, you know, we just got mobbed by young teenage girls who kind of freaked us out a bit, you know, because we weren't used to that. But we got used to it all right. It was just a different scene in the States. And that,
I bet.
And that, like we did things like the Ed Sullivan shows, that did that several times. That had an audience of millions every week. 25 million, I think, was average for them. We did another show called Hullabaloo, which had Sammy Davis Jr. as the host. That was a lot of fun. Wow. He's a funny guy. And so we got a lot of television in the States and, you know, a lot of big following. We still have now, you know.
Did you come out of the Ed Sullivan show with ringing in your ears from all the screaming?
I've still got ringing in my ears, you know. I got... like most drummers, I've got tinnitus. Yeah.
And what about the famous story of when you arrived in New York for that Ed Sullivan performance, and you almost had like the arrival of a traveling dignitary or head of state, didn't you? Because it was a motorcade that drove you through the streets.
That's right.
What was that like? What do you remember of that?
I remember it very well because it was a stunt that was dreamed of by the record label, you know, to promote the first time in the States. And there was a British sports car by a company called Triumph. Mm-hmm. And it was a popular car in the UK, Triumph Spitfire, I think it was called. But in the States, they called it the Triumph Tiger. So some piano guy got there. Oh, a tiger, animals. Oh. we got this huge press reception when we landed, and the screaming kids all over the place on the roofs and things. And then they took us down, and there's five of these two-seater sports cars lined up over the top. And each one of us had a six-foot model with fishnet stuff, with a big basque, whiskers, and a tiger's tail.
Oh,
and we sat up on the back seat of the car with a driver, each of us, with our arm around this model, and took off towards Manhattan with a motorcycle escort, you know, wailing sirens. It was hilarious.
Oh, my word. A bunch of guys from the Northeast, a bunch of Geordies, and you're getting receptions like that in New York. I mean, let's be honest, the UK in the 60s was a dark place at times, wasn't it? It was pretty gloomy, and then you go across and you get that. I mean, how were you feeling at that time?
Oh, it was ridiculous. I mean, there's some footage you can find on YouTube of that whole thing, and it just seems we were all looking at each other, you know, in this convoy, and turning around and going, what? What's going on, you know? And arrived in our hotel in downtown Manhattan with kids all over the sidewalk screaming and shouting and mobbing us, and it was good fun.
Absolutely, good fun indeed. Now, obviously, the British Invasion was huge, and you were the second British band just after the Beatles, weren't you, to have the number one in America?
Yeah.
Now, there was a lot of bands that went over and did the sort of stuff. I've spoke to many as well that have been over there: Colin Blunstone and Kenny and Rick Lee and John Lodge from the Moody Blues and all these sorts of people. I mean, you went over there, a lot of bands were over there from the UK. Did you manage to brush shoulders with them, or was it literally ships in the night passing? You maybe see them at an airport or a live gig or something like that. What was that like?
Yeah, pretty much like that. There was one occasion when we met up with the Hermits in Los Angeles, and they were there to do either a recording or a movie or something. I can't remember what. And they had rented the house that used to be owned by Cary Grant, you know, the film star.
Yeah.
And we had a party there one night, and it had like loads of glass out onto a pool, you know. And I was drinking vodka and tonic, and I thought I was drinking vodka and tonic, but it turned out I was drinking vodka and Bacardi. I was stopping it. And I should walk her up with my So I passed out and fell off my stool. And then I woke up just as I hit the water, because they stretched me out on the diving board, fully clothed, you know. And I'd rolled over in my sleep and pushed into the pool. So that was one of the rare kind of get togethers with members of the British people, you know, but mostly it was just sort of, hey, how are you doing? And we did a TV studio and that kind of thing, you know.
Phenomenal stuff and phenomenal success that you had within the band. It really is incredible. And another big name to throw out there, I mean, Bruce Springsteen saying that you guys were his favourite band of the 60s. And when you think of the bands that were around, the Yardbirds and the Beatles and Cream and the Stones, I mean, that must have been an incredible feeling to hear someone like that say that about you guys.
It was that was very, very generous of him. And he did a whole tour a few short years ago with every night he said that to the audience, you know, this is, you know, misunderstood, it's my life, and we got to get out of this place. He says, that's my whole repertoire. Every song I write is based on those three songs, you know, by the Animals. We go, wow. How bad is that?
Not bad at all. Now, I've got a couple of questions as well from my listeners. I put it out to my my newsletter to see if there's any questions for you. And I've got one here from Vries Hagen, who I believe is in Holland. He says, my favourite song by the Animals is Please Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, which is very different to the Nina Simone version. How did the band decide what songs to record?
Quite often it was Mickey Most would make occasional trips to New York, the famous Brill Building, where all the songwriters, it was like a factory, a song factory, you know, and come back with test pressings of songs for, they just used to write songs for other people, you know, mainly. But, you know, Carole King was one of those songs, Neil Sedaka, Carole Goffin and King, Man and Wheel, Barry Mann, Cynthia Wheel. They just used to churn out songs and for everybody. So it was one of those. I can't remember who brought us that song. We weren't aware of Nina Simone's version of it at the time, but so we just did our own arrangement of it, you know. And then we had a bit of a spat with Nina, you know, later on when we were on a TV show with her, and she was pretty angry woman. Wow, stroppy. She had a right go at us for being, you know, little white boys pinching my song, you know. And Eric said, "That's your song. You didn't write it. It's Benny Benjamin wrote the song, you know. I mean, we just did a version of it." She was really snapping and snarling, she was, you know. But wow. Eric stood his ground, and we had a bigger hit with it, you know, in the short term, you know, and chart wise. I mean, her version's never got tired ever. You know, it's a brilliant version. My daughter's favorite version of it is Nina Simone. she always said, "You did that too fast, you know. You need someone to get a better version, you know."
Where's the loyalty? Eh? So just following up on that question there from Vries, when Mickey came back with songs, or whenever these songs came towards you, did you guys then sit and go through the songs perhaps, and then work out which ones to do and which ones not to do?
Yeah, we had the sort of, we had the right of refuse, you know. When Mickey would suggest this stuff, if we didn't like it, we didn't do it. So simple as that, you know. But half the time when we went into the studio, it would be the first time we played it. So, and while we're in recording whatever single in a B side, we'd usually knock off a few other tracks as well for that would turn up on an album a little bit later, you know. We did everything seat of pants, you know. It was because we were so together with each other. It was almost like telepathy, you know. So what we just listen to a record once and we go and knock it out with our own twist to it, you know.
Wow, phenomenal stuff. And another question here from DK Rayner. He says, "Do you ever look back and wish that you'd stayed together as a band longer, given the continued success of the likes of the Beatles and the Stones, and given where the Animals were at that point?"
Yeah. It's an interesting thought.
I suppose it's more complicated than that, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, I don't believe too much in if only we'd done this, or what if we'd done that, blah, blah, blah. It's what happens, you know, so you just get up and get on with it.
Absolutely. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, John. We look forward to catching you on tour, and I hope everyone gets their tickets to see you guys on your farewell tour, and I hope that we get to see you as well.
It's going to be a long farewell tour, Paul.
yes, absolutely.
I've got 2 years to make up for from this pandemic.
Absolutely, indeed. And we'll hopefully catch you as well at the Great British Blues Festival as well in the summer.
Looking forward to that.
The brilliant John Steele there. Fantastic stories indeed. Definitely do check out the Animals and Friends if they're touring near you. They came up here to the Highlands of Scotland not long ago as well. Fantastic stuff. Definitely check them out if you get a chance to. Please do. Right, now it's the time of the show for my top fives. And of course, this week I'm going to give you my favourite five songs from the Animals. But first, some of your comments from last week's top five In Excess songs. Let's start with Patrick O'Brien. He said Taste It was his choice, but that the 12-inch version of Suicide Blonde is fantastic. I just remember the days of the 12-inch record. Kids wouldn't have a clue these days, would they? It's fantastic, even just to say it. Toby Williams said Devil Inside was his favourite, while Joey Michaud agreed with my top three and then also included Devil Inside and Never Tear Us Apart. Over on Twitter, Joe from Play That Rock and Roll, he had Listen Like Thieves as his number one In Excess song, and also included in his top five Pretty Vegas, a track from the post-Michael Hutchence era. Now, Joe said he watched the TV show Rockstar In Excess when he was in high school, and In Excess was one of his first concerts he went to, so he really enjoyed the album they did with JD Fortune as frontman. Prime Mover Media, they throw up a couple of different tracks in their selection, Original Sin and The One Thing, while Analog Smile had a really diverse selection from their five, which included The Stairs, I Send a Message and Doctor. Love those shouts. And I'll say it now, if you haven't checked out episode 62 with INXS's Andrew Farris, now he was the main songwriter in the band, then please, please go back and do so. Anyway, let's get to the animals then. Remember, this is my personal choice. It's highly subjective. I don't expect you to agree. In fact, I'd love to hear how you disagree. So please reach out with your own top five this week, and I'll give you a mention on next week's programme. So here you go, my top five animal songs according to Vintage Rock Pod. At five is a track that wasn't originally on an album, I don't think, but it was a big hit, one of their many top 10 hits here in the UK. Hilton Valentine's distinctive picking style was very evident, as was Eric's low gravelly vocals in the opening, building to a big chorus refrain. At five is It's My Life. At four is one of their signature songs, and one that got them into a little spat with Nina Simone. From the album Animal Tracks, at four, it's Please Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood. I'm just a song whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. At three is another song from the Animal Tracks album and another big hit. It builds beautifully, as many of their songs did, and was a big hit with the US Armed Forces in Vietnam. At three is We Gotta Get Out of This Place. Two is their lead single from their 1966 album Animalization. It's a rip-roaring song with so much energy and another great vocal from Eric Burdon. And number two is Inside Looking Out. And at number one, well, not much of a surprise, really, because it's one of the all-time greats, instantly recognisable from the very first second. Their version of this traditional song was a massive hit worldwide and remains hugely popular today. No more needs to be said. The number one animal song on my list is, of course, House of the Rising Sun. So there you go, my top five songs from The Animals. As I said, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this list. Where do you agree or disagree? Let me know. Email vintagerockpod@gmail.com, or you can catch me on any of the social media platforms. I do hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, please hit subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening to this on so you don't miss any more future episodes, especially the new This Day Rocks episodes, which head your way every single day, just to give you a short snippet, a little 5-minute burst of classic rock goodness. It's been met with great reception, so thank you to everyone who's reached out these last couple of weeks about these new shows. Also, please do check out Vintage Rock Pod on the social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Give us a like, a follow. It would be most appreciated. Well, that's it for me then on this episode. I'll be back tomorrow with another This Day Rocks and a big interview for you next week with another act who's playing at the Great British Rhythm and Blues Festival. Until then, though, if you come across anyone who isn't a fan of rock, just tell them, my music is better than yours. Take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.